The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, John Dennis here on Friday, September the 12th. Today, Gordon Brown prepares for Saturday lunchtime at Chequers, when he'll be receiving a special guest.
Well, Margaret Thatcher is going to be making a nostalgic return visit to Chequers so that Lady Thatcher can embark on a tour of the grounds, which she evidently very much liked doing when she was Prime Minister.
A top biologist has called for British schools to allow creationism to be taught in science lessons.
Creationism is not science, and it should not be given equal time in science lessons, and it shouldn't be presented by science teachers as a scientifically valid alternative.
And we speak to John Barnes about swapping football boots for ballet shoes.
When Graham Taylor actually had us doing it, it was all about trying to get the coordination right without the ball, and if you can get the coordination right without the ball, then when the ball is introduced, it makes it that much easier.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
In Zimbabwe, a power-sharing deal between President Mugabe and the opposition MDC has finally been worked out by the mediator, President Mbeki of South Africa. The full details will be announced on Monday at a signing ceremony. But the Guardian's been told that after 28 years, Mugabe has agreed to share power. The MDC won a majority in Parliament, and now their leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, will become Prime Minister, chairing a council made up of his and Mugabe's party members. In Britain, the holiday firm XL has collapsed, leaving more than 80,000 travellers stranded. The XL Leisure Group flies to 50 destinations using its own airline, which has now been grounded. The Atoll scheme will help many holidaymakers home, and the Civil Aviation Authority is arranging for aircraft to be chartered. But many passengers are not registered under the scheme if they booked online or through a call centre. A further 200,000 people will have lost their holidays, as the company is the third biggest holiday firm in the country. More thousands of people are stranded after a fire in the Channel Tunnel. The fire broke out in a lorry aboard a freight train yesterday afternoon. There were no injuries. 14 people were taken to hospital after inhaling smoke. Eurostar says it will be unable to run any trains today while the fire is still being fought and then the debris cleared. There are suggestions services will be disrupted for some time. The United States is involved in a diplomatic dispute with Venezuela. Last week, Bolivia expelled the US ambassador, accusing him of aiding protests against the government. President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela has now ordered the US ambassador to his country to be withdrawn in solidarity with Bolivia. This is only days after Chavez invited Russian Air Force bombers to deploy to his country. The Times chooses the Zimbabwe story for its front page, while the Telegraph picks on the Channel Tunnel fire, which it calls a near disaster. The Guardian hands its front page over to American News. It has an exclusive report that President Bush has signed a secret order giving US special forces in Afghanistan free rein to cross into Pakistan to attack terrorists. NATO, which also has troops in the country, has told the paper it does not support cross-border attacks. The other Guardian story is about Sarah Palin, the Republican candidate for vice president, and how she is now being allowed to talk to the media. After being kept away for a week, she'll now appear for a series of television interviews. Most of the back pages continue their pursuit of Theo Walcott, England's new football star, with pictures. His England manager warns the Independent he won't always score hat-tricks, as does Arsenal's boss, who won't necessarily put him in the opening team lineup. More news and sport through the day on guardian.co.uk.
Tomorrow, Margaret Thatcher's returning to Chequers, the Prime Minister's country residence, at the invitation of Gordon Brown. They're expected to discuss the global economic downturn. The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt, says that in contrast to last year's visit to Downing Street by the former PM, Brown's advisers want this visit to be more low-key.
The visit has been carefully timed to take place whilst the weather is still good, so that Lady Thatcher can embark on a nostalgic tour of the grounds, which she evidently very much liked doing when she was Prime Minister.
The Iron Chancellor and the Iron Lady, what will Gordon Brown be talking about with her?
Well, it's interesting. I think we'll find that Downing Street will want to handle the lunch with care because there was a mixed legacy from Gordon Brown's meeting with Prime Minister with the former Prime Minister in Downing Street last year, which actually took place a year to the day. It was the 13th of September last year. There was a mixed legacy. People on the left were not impressed, and Conservatives were very uneasy. They felt that Gordon Brown was using a frail elderly lady to sort of appeal to Middle England. So he will want to be handling this meeting with care, but they will obviously discuss the full range of things across the political spectrum. But Margaret Thatcher is in frail health. Her daughter, Carol, announced a few weeks ago that she's been suffering from dementia from some time, that her short-term memory is not good, but that she does come alive when she discusses the past, particularly when she was Prime Minister. So it will be handled delicately.
Is there any political capital to be made out of this for Gordon Brown?
Well, I think the timing will be significant. We are entering the political conference season, and also for Gordon Brown, his premiership is clearly in a difficult position, and he is going to want to and going to have a very good conference season if he's going to be strong and is going to survive. And where I think the potential significance is that the European Commission has warned this week that Britain is going to face a recession. And who was the Prime Minister who faced some of the most difficult economic conditions in the post-war period? It was Margaret Thatcher. And one of the things that Gordon Brown is going to want to do over the next few months is sort of show a more humble Gordon Brown that I get it, I know how serious things are. And if he is hearing from the woman who dealt with the really difficult economic conditions of the early 1980s, and he's talking to her particularly, former Prime Minister, that he made his name out of attacking when he was a young backbencher, then that may feed into the idea that this is a more humble Gordon Brown. But I think you'll find that Downing Street will not want to make any political capital out of this. And they will, I imagine, they will want to say, look, the two of them met last year. They talked about Chequers. Gordon Brown said to Lady Thatcher, you're very welcome to come back to Chequers whenever you want. It's a long-standing engagement. And one of the things that they want to do is to allow Lady Thatcher to walk through the grounds, because that's particularly nostalgic, and particularly so because she used to do that with her husband, Sir Dennis Thatcher, who, of course, died in 2003.
Nick Watt. And there's full coverage of politics today at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website, as the UN considers putting the UK's World Heritage Sites on its at-risk list, Simon Jenkins asks how and why did we get to the point where bureaucrats in Paris have to come to the rescue of British public design? Guardian.co.uk/comment is free to have your say on that. The latest on yesterday's fire in the Channel Tunnel at guardian.co.uk/transport, and our critic Alexis Petridis reviews Queen's comeback album with Paul Rodgers on vocals. It's not as bad as the stage musical We Will Rock You, he says, at guardian.co.uk/music. An eminent biologist and education expert has been arguing for creationism to be taught in school science lessons. The Reverend Professor Michael Rice, Director of Education at the Royal Society, made the call at the British Association Festival of Science at the University of Liverpool. He argues that banning creationism from the classroom will make children with religious beliefs less likely to be persuaded by the concept of evolution. Professor Rice has been talking to The Guardian's science correspondent, James Randerson.
A lot of science teachers have always assumed that if any student brings up creationism in the classroom, the best thing to do is just to either ignore it, tell them that it's got nothing to do with the science they're studying, or that they should raise it in an RE lesson or somewhere. But the number of students coming into science classrooms in the United Kingdom who have creationist beliefs or who come from families with creationist beliefs is growing. So science teachers are finding more and more students with these sorts of views. And from my own experience of having tried to teach biology and science for many years, whether to 11 to 19 year olds or undergraduates, is I've now changed what I try and do. I used to try and deal with students who believed in creationism as if this was a simple scientific misconception. A bit like thinking that plants get most of their mass from the soil, and that a bit of good teaching could help them understand that they were wrong. This isn't the case. Students who believe in creationism often believe in it not because of a scientific misconception, but because they have a completely different way of understanding the world. They literally have a different world view. And what I now see my job as an educator to do is to help them to understand the scientific theory of evolution and, if teaching cosmology, the almost universally accepted scientific ideas that the universe is 13 or 14 billion years old, etc. But not to try and force it on them as the correct way of understanding the world, the universe. Helping them to see that it's the almost universally accepted scientific way, and in this way, I hope both to respect them as students, but actually ensure they learn more science than if they're presented with science as if it's going to trample over their beliefs.
What do you say to the position of someone like Richard Dawkins or Lewis Wolpert that those positions, creationism, it just simply isn't science? It's not a scientific theory and it has no place in a scientific lesson or a science lesson.
Both Richard and Lewis are right that creationism is not science and it should not be given equal time in science lessons and it shouldn't be presented by science teachers as a scientifically valid alternative. But as a teacher, I'm comfortable when dealing in science lessons with what students bring to the lesson, even if it isn't good science. So I'd want to acknowledge, without in any way ridiculing the student, and this might be perhaps where I differ from certainly Richard Dawkins in a science lesson, I'd want to acknowledge that for the student, that is how they understand the world, and I can respect them for that, but I want to make it very clear that's not the way the overwhelming majority of scientists understand the world, and we have very good evidence-based reasons as to why scientists understand the world they do, and then nothing would delight me more than to get into the scientific evidence for evolution or the history of the universe.
You mentioned ridiculing there. Are you implying that sometimes Richard Dawkins does that?
I would not accuse Richard himself of doing that, but I've seen science teachers on discussion boards and I've seen scientists, when debating with students, behave in a way that conveys the impression you are talking rubbish. As a science teacher, I think I would almost never want to give students that impression.
Professor Michael Rice talking to James Randerson. And there's a special edition of the Science Weekly podcast on Monday, including the tale of the Swedish nurse and the stroking machine. That's a scientific experiment, before you ask, to find the optimum stroking velocity. Guardian.co.uk/science on Monday for that. My name's John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, football's most beautiful moments replayed by ballet dancers. And the Gurkhas and their families' legal battle continues over UK visas.
People talk of the sword of justice, the sword that cuts through the evidence and gets to the truth. We will see the cookery of justice cutting through to the truth.
But first, six Greenpeace climate change activists have been cleared of causing criminal damage on a coal-fired power station. They'd scaled a 200-foot chimney and written the name Gordon on it. But the jury backed their defence that they had a lawful excuse. They argued that they were protecting property, huge areas of land around the world, from the damage caused by climate change. Our environment editor John Vidal has been considering the implications of Wednesday's verdict at Maidstone Crown Court.
If you are an environmentalist, you would hype up the fact that this is going to open the floodgates to all manner of protests about climate change. And you will see coal companies, oil companies, gas companies, all kinds of different energy companies being targeted increasingly by protesters claiming a legitimate excuse to protest against them. On the other hand, it may not do that. It may actually begin to help shape British energy policy, because it looks fantastically difficult now for any government to say we're going to go ahead with expanding coal when juries have actually said, no, this is so urgent that the law has to be broken.
This is because to build coal-fired power stations would actually damage property, the court found.
What the court was told was by one of the world's leading climate scientist Jim Hansen, who advises Al Gore, who's the chief scientist at NASA. Basically, he said that climate change is now so serious it threatens to wipe out 40,000 species, of which this particular coal plant at King's North was going to be responsible for at least 400. And he said, effectively, that more people should be getting out there and protesting and chaining themselves to the gates of power stations. He actually wrote a letter to Gordon Brown a few months ago urging him to abandon Britain's expansion of coal, saying it would be absolutely catastrophic for the climate. And the signals which this gives out for climate change protesters and governments around the world is very, very clear. Coal is dirty, coal is dangerous, and it is now seemingly legal to target it.
One of the witnesses in this case was Zach Goldsmith, environmental advisor to David Cameron, of course. Will the Tories halt plans to build a new generation of coal-fired power stations?
I think everything is in the offing at the moment. What you've got is government, which is trying to work out whether to allow King's North, this huge power station which these activists climbed up, whether it should be allowed to expand. And there's a huge split in cabinet at the moment between John Hutton, the business secretary, the energy secretary, who says, yes, we need coal to be able to keep the lights on, and Hilary Benn, the environment secretary, and David Miliband, the previous environment secretary, who have both been arguing very strongly, no, we do not need, we must not have coal. We can go down any other road, but we cannot have dirty coal. We could have coal with carbon capture and storage, but we cannot have coal as it exists today. I think what this jury has said is that government is going to have to think again. It cannot go down the dirty coal route anymore. So it could have very, very far-reaching consequences.
And we can expect more direct action.
Yes, I think there was going to be direct action anyway, because there's a great mood building up at the grassroots against coal. So a bit like GM, a bit like the Rhodes protests and whatever, going back 10 years or more, you are seeing grassroots groups now being led by organisations like Greenpeace, who've got huge resources, taking on climate change as a major issue of the day. This is bound to encourage direct action. It's bound to encourage protesters to go that little bit extra further. They know that they can, quote, do a bit of damage, and they can use this defence in court. What will happen, I suspect, is that those cases won't go to a jury anymore. They will just go to a magistrate.
John Vidal. Next week, the case of 15 former Gurkhas and Gurkha widows, representing more than 2,000 of their former colleagues, will return to the High Court in London. A team of human rights lawyers is challenging the lawfulness of decisions to refuse the men entry visas to the UK. Well, there's a special film about the Gurkhas and their campaign on The Guardian's website today. Audrey Gillen reports.
Guy and Indra Rai fought and almost died for the British Army in the Falklands. A quarter of a century later, he is again fighting a battle, this time against the British government, to secure the right of Gurkha veterans who retired before July 1997 to live in the UK.
I remember the Falkland Islands. I saw many horrible things at that time, so I have certain nightmares.
More than 1,000 of his fellow veterans attended a rally in Pokhara to hear about their legal fight. They came from the Gurkha heartlands in the surrounding hills. The guests of honour were the British lawyers representing them.
How are you?
People talk of the sword of justice. The sword that cuts through the evidence and gets to the truth. We will see the cookery of justice cutting through to the truth.
The kukri is the knife that has become the symbol of Gurkha bravery. The Gurkha motto is, it is better to die than live a coward. More than 50,000 have died fighting for the British across two centuries. In July 1997, Gurkha headquarters were relocated to the UK. The Home Office argues that those Gurkhas who were based outside the UK could not have developed strong ties with the country. For many of the older Gurkha veterans, this feels like a betrayal, and the visa has become a matter of principle. For Captain Lalit Garum, it is about the chance to end his life in health and with dignity. Following in the footsteps of his forefathers, he served for 24 years alongside his three brothers. He fought in the jungle in the Malayan Emergency, led 32 men during the revolution in Brunei, and for his bravery was awarded the Military Cross. 12 years ago, the captain had a stroke which paralysed half his body. He wants to go to the UK for medical treatment, unavailable in Nepal.
The British are the biggest empire in the world, the most famous one. They are moving around waving the Union Jack, but what did we get? Nothing. Even when we are so sick, they don't care. We have got nothing.
To apply for a visa, the captain has to embark on an arduous 7-hour drive to Kathmandu. As he does not have the £500 fee required, he knows he may be refused. The British lawyers want to challenge these conditions, which make it physically and financially very difficult for many veterans to apply.
When I was seriously injured in Falkland War, my British colleagues gave me blood and skin. Why not strong ties? I have literally English blood running in my body.
Audrey Gillen reporting, and you can see Audrey's film at guardian.co.uk/military.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
The English National Ballet's latest project is called The Beautiful Game, a football ballet. They're aiming to recreate in ballet 10 great footballing moments. The Guardian's Helen Pidd reports from London's Unicorn Theatre.
So I'm here with John Barnes, former footballer. Can you tell me, what are the similarities between football and ballet?
I find the similarity between not just football and ballet, but all sports, is the coordination of footwork. Football is fairly obvious when it comes to footwork because you're actually kicking a ball, and ballet, you're dancing, so the footwork is obvious. Interestingly, if you speak to boxers, or you speak to where you think it's all about punching, it's all about footwork, getting your body in a position to perform whatever move you have to do. Cricket is exactly the same, basketball, so footwork in all sports and all dance is very similar.
So did Graham Taylor introduce you to ballet? Was that your first sort of taste of it?
Well, yeah, and as I said, you know, we had one or two classes, so it's not as if we did it every week, but I know that Coventry did it quite regularly, so a lot of football clubs have done it. The only thing is that you have to do it regularly to really get the benefits from it. So it may have been a little bit gimmicky, but the message behind it was, you know, concentrate on your footwork and, you know, you will improve as a footballer. And, of course, you can't do ballet as a footballer because you've got two matches to play, you've got to train, so you can't do that regularly. But just to think about the coordination steps is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is more technically difficult, ballet or football?
Ballet is much more technically difficult because there are lots of different ways of playing football, depending on what position you play, how tall you are. There's no right or wrong way of playing football. You know, people can dribble differently, they can do whatever they want, whereas ballet, you have to be not only technically proficient, but you have to do it in a particular way. The ballet dancer's steps have to be the same. You can't be different. Whereas in football, it's really depending on the individual. So technically, ballet is much more technical.
So I'm here with Jenna Lee, who is the choreographer of this football ballet from the English National Ballet. I'm just wondering, what do you think is more technically difficult, football or ballet?
It's a really hard question. I mean, I know when we've had footballers in before to rehearse with us, they've always kind of gone, oh my God, this is so hard. And, you know, even trying to lift the women up, you know, the boys are boys at the ballet, make it look so effortless, you know. Whereas I suppose footballers, they can show the pain and the grit and I don't know, it's a bit of both. They both require so much strength, flexibility, coordination. So yeah, I'd say it's on a par with each other, really.
Do you get many footballers coming to train with you guys?
I think we had Crystal Palace in a couple of years ago, which was entertaining for everyone involved.
And what was the attitude of the footballers when they kind of sauntered into your studio? Did they think it was going to be easier than it actually was?
I think they kind of came in with a bit of a front, oh, we'll find this easy, and, you know, I wonder what this is all about. But actually, they came in a lot more accepting than I thought they would. A few years ago, maybe 10, 20 years ago, I don't think people you know, like John said, you know, they kind of feel a bit funny when they first start doing it. But now ballet's so in the public eye, it's so much more accessible, but they all seem quite relaxed and happy to get on with it, really.
And John Barnes has said today that he thought that footballers don't train nearly as hard as ballet dancers. As a ballet dancer, would you like to earn a footballer's wage, given that he said that you work harder?
Absolutely. It's especially, I mean, we work very long hours. We start at 10:30, and if we're doing a show, we don't finish till 11 in the evening. We might have done two shows that day. So doing about 10 shows a week, one day off a week, just, yeah, 6 weeks off a year. It's a tough living, definitely.
And out of interest, what's the average wage of just a non-principal dancer at the English National Ballet?
Oh, I'd say a week, probably about £300.
Compared to £100,000 for a footballer.
Theo Walcott, eat your heart out. Helen Pidd reporting. My name's John Dennis. Today's producers were Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.